Okay, hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. I'm your host, Mark Locks, and I'm in Brisbane in Australia. And today we're talking to Jeffrey McIlwain, who is in San Diego. And we're going to talk about his co-authored book, Deconstructing Organized Crime, an Historical and Theoretical Study. Hi, Jeffrey. How are you?
Hello. Doing great. Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much indeed for being on the show today.
I appreciate being here.
I'll just preface things by saying Jeff and I actually tried to record this interview at the American Society of Criminology Conference in November, and through a whole range of missing each other and not finding a quiet location, it's taken us a while to actually finally get this recording going.
Our scheduling makes duck soup look like it's a serious drama.
That's right. So, now, as I said, you're co-author on this with the now late Joe Albini. If we could just start off with a bit of background about you, and then we might spend some time talking about Joe.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I don't know how much if this is unique in terms of my background coming in as a scholar, but basically, I'm the first in my family has gone to university, and. I had family members that have involved in some, how should I say, some other activities that I have chosen to write about. It was never my inspiration, but it was something that, growing up in Los Angeles and having a grandfather that used to collect money for some folks that worked out of the docks over in San Pedro in Los Angeles Harbor. Another great uncle started one of the major street gangs in Los Angeles during the Pachuco days, the days of the Zoot Suits, and it went on to become a feeder gang for the Mexican Mafia, among other things. Being kind of one of the first of my families to kind of move out from the cities in the classic ways, my parents provided an opportunity for me to go to a place further out in the suburbs that provided a strong education. But I still grew up kind of having learned certain things from some family members and stories and other things that kind of provided a frame of reference for me. It kind of gave me a template to understand the difference between the academic and the real. But that's not what I wanted to do. Originally, I went on to basically study national security and study international affairs and history. I did that through my master's degree. I worked with a scholar named John Lewis Gaddis, who just won the Pulitzer, excellent Cold War historian and national security expert, among others. And the idea was at the time I wanted to emphasize on kind of some of the new emerging security threats that we were going to be facing in the post-Cold War era. As we were engaged in that education, that's when the Berlin Wall was falling and a variety of things were going on. And I was really interested in this concept of the new evil empire. And I decided at that point to begin looking at the area of criminology, because I really felt that my security background and my history background, international affairs, was pretty solid, and that I could go ahead and try to give myself more of a theoretical background and a research and methodological background that would allow me to be able to look at the subject in a different way that most scholars at the time were not doing. And so I applied to different graduate programs, and the one I really wanted to go to is the one I ended up going to, which was at Penn State, which at the time had an incredible faculty for this. I was fortunate enough to study under the directorship of Alan Block, who's just like myself, fancies himself a historical criminologist. Philip Jenkins was there at the time, and his phenomenal work on moral panics and other things. Tom Bernard, Stephen Ostrovsky was, in the policing realm. So it was really a vibrant time and a vibrant era. I took some time off. I studied at the Garda College in Ireland to study terrorism in the good old days when the IRA and the various troubles that were going on there, the terrorism and counterterrorism. Basically focused on the history of organized crime. Started with my first book, which is on a history of the notion of new and emerging threats of organized crime, and showing how a lot of the assumptions we took as researchers into that were not historically founded, that organized crime worked very well with groups outside of their own ethnic groups, that they had worked heavily with people in the upper world, that they would manipulate reform movements and be involved with the full large urban political structures and the political machine structures in the United States. The book is Organizing Crime in Chinatown, and in particular the Chinese community, not just in New York City, but across the country, and was able to show quite significantly that there were some major transnational criminal organizations over 100 years ago, as well as major involvement with what we would refer to as traditional organized crime at that time. And then a bunch of other work went into the realm of, once again, uncovering the historical foundations for the research that we have looking at the history, for example, of how did drug trafficking begin on the U.S.-Mexican border. So I looked into that and found involvement with, for example, German intelligence and helping to use drug proceeds to help fund, you know, all these different things. It's kind of Iran-Contra in reverse, you know, and it's pretty interesting, but it really set the template. And there's these wonderful documents you can find in the archives, much more advanced than anybody would think. You know, for example, just one smuggling syndicate had 115 people stretching from Hong Kong through Canada, Mexico, Hawaii, the United States, you know, addresses, names. And, you know, if you had the modern social analysis packages that I was at the time when I was doing this research, it would have been great. The geospatial information would have been fantastic. But then also looking at the history of immigrant smuggling, particularly during the Chinese Exclusion Act, that was an area I was working on for a book when 9/11 hit. And then after 9/11, I ended up working and co-founding the first graduate program in Homeland Security in the United States. And we now have a program of about 130 grad students from various professions and fields. So I've been heavily working now in the war college environment here in the States and also with some of our strategic partners all around the globe. But talking about how organized crime interacts with particularly the missions of special forces as it relates to regular warfare, terrorism, counterterrorism, things along those lines. So heavily involved in working with the folks in the applied side of things, on the Department of Homeland Security side, Department of Justice side, in that area, and then continuing just to do the research that I've been doing in terms of article forms. And now, having had the opportunity and transitioning over to Joe, being able to work with Joe is the next step before moving on to some other projects. So that's it in a nutshell, I guess.
Yeah, there's your entire life. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Try the veal.
Now, there's probably quite a few people listening who really don't know who Joe Albini mm-hmm. was. So do you want to give us another potted history then of his life yes. and achievements?
Yeah, Joe Albini, this project for this book began at an Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences meeting in Las Vegas. I had the opportunity to review a manuscript that Joe Albini had created, which was for a press that he took as kind of being one of the deans or really the founder of the revisionist movement in organized crime studies in the early 1970s, that he viewed as kind of writing a first-person narrative. This is looking back on my career and the various things that were out there. And the publisher wanted something different. Very different. It was a very large manuscript, and I thought very brilliant in the way it was constructed, and it was very unique in the sense that you really had one of the major folks in the field kind of giving a first-person view of all the various changes and all the various things that have happened. Well, the editor wanted something else, and he asked around, and my name was given to him by a couple of scholars, and then Joe recommended me as well. We had the opportunity to meet a number of times, and he was a very kind supporter of mine. And so I got brought into the project. And this was quite a long time ago, actually. This project, the book ended up taking about 6 years because of different delays with the publisher got sold another one, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the next thing you know, a few years had gone by before the actual book came out. But Joe is an incredibly good man. And I still think is a brilliant scholar. He came up in a day and age when there was conventional wisdom about organized crime being, you know, bigger than U.S. Steel, and to use the old Hyman Roth or whatever quote from The Godfather. The idea of this kind of dominant structural functional perspective in sociology that was very strong during the 1960s. And the idea being that you have this major corporation and there's control and there's policies and procedures, etc. And Joe had the opportunity to be involved with some of the work with Donald Cressy, who's one of the major academic proponent of that perspective. And as Joe was working on this project, and this project, by the way, was influencing a major piece of legislation in the U.S., the Omnibus Crime Control Act in 1968, that created the RICO statute, or conspiracy laws, or racketeer-influenced corrupt organization law. And so he was looking at this, and he was saying, you know what, I'm looking at things here, and I don't see concrete evidence for what's being asserted in this perspective of this, you know, large La Cosa Nostra thing. And he began to look deeper and deeper and deeper and looked at the testimony from congressional hearings and all the other sources that were being used, and he couldn't find it being used. And he couldn't see it. He saw, as a matter of fact, quite contradictory evidence they had a lot of decentralized networks that might be connected to each other through family ties, people having grown up in similar neighborhoods and things along those lines, or the various enterprises that people were engaged in necessitated contacts in different countries. And so he published a book on basically about the generation of this kind of mafia legend, as he would call it. And he basically took a sociological and anthropological perspective to the subject that emphasized the decentralized nature. And this was fascinating when it came out, because Joe was basically tarred and feathered by his peers and by many in the professional field. I mean, the fact that his name is Albini made many people immediately think that, of course, he's saying this. He's Italian. He got paid off by the mob. The mafia paid him off, you know. And he was literally in interviews and old tapes of these floating around that Joe had where, you know, people are basically saying, are you being paid by the mob to say this? Is this part of the great conspiracy and the lie? You know, it's like it's conspiracy thinking 101, you know, and when you try to, you know, so he went through a lot of hard knocks. But at the same time that he was working, there were other scholars like Anton Bloch in anthropology, Jane and Catherine Snyder in anthropology, Dwight Smith comes out, Peter Reuter in economics, Alan Bloch, who I worked with as a historian, that all begin to start chipping away at either the economic foundations of the myth, at the anthropological foundations, sociological, the Yannis did the same thing from anthropology, sociology, you know, so eventually this starts a whole revisionist movement. And Joe, you know, was very involved with that. And what I find fascinating is how many people that I've talked to in our field who, whether they agreed with Joe's conclusions or not, have said nothing but the fact that he was one of the most incredible gentlemen that I've ever met, that he is also somebody that would encourage and support, that he took young scholars like myself. I mean, the first time I gave a paper presentation, Jay Albanese, another very well-regarded scholar, he was the chair of the panel, and I was a young, you know, fledgling grad student, first paper at a conference, and afterwards, this nice man says, I really found that paper on Chinese organized crime fascinating, and the history, and wow, this is neat, and it ends up being a two-hour conversation. It took me to lunch, and then this guy is Joe Albini. And I was like, wow, this is Joe Albini. This is great. I mean, I'm working with Alan Bloch, which is phenomenal, but man, Joe Albini, this is cool. And then I go to find out later on that he did that for a lot of other people. And he did that he took a very strong interest in people's work, particularly young scholars, and was an advocate for them in many ways. And so when the opportunity came to work with him, I was very blessed by that and very thankful for that opportunity.
Mm. That's fantastic. So let's move on to the book itself then. And sure. The first part of the book really addresses the issues that you just discussed in relation to Joe and how he was trying to review that mythology or the mafia mythology.
Mm-hmm. Yes, what we're doing in that chapter and is what some other scholars have done as well. I mean, Alan Bloch, I mean, yes. I think in many ways, most notably, but others as well, is that from a criminological perspective, a sociological perspective, much of the work that's been done on organized crime is really takes the view that organized crime is a picture, that we get a snapshot. You know, this is agricultural fraud in the European Union in 2008, and these are the stats that were generated, or this is the picture of a crime family in a particular city, and we're going to analyze that one thing. And for those of us that are more historically inclined, we look at organized crime as a continuation of a number of various historical processes, all of which are evolutionary in many ways, and that, in a sense, as opposed to looking at organized crime as a picture, we need to look at it as a film. We need to look at it as a continuously moving film where the players change and the law can change and change the opportunities and the structures and the networks can change. People get arrested. People, you know, retire. People get out of the life. People go to prison. And there's this continuity that can occur that if we look at it from a long-term perspective, we can get some other views on this. Because oftentimes what we find is that communities, and particularly in our discipline, is that communities of scholars can begin to accept a lot of mythologies as fact, but where they're not really based in real strong history. And that's, I know I can't speak for other university systems in other countries, but in the United States, we actually looked at this. I was working on some curriculum development in my program. And I was surveying the major programs across the country, and there is an absolute dearth of history of criminal justice or history of criminology courses. Now, when you think of that, there's other social sciences that spend a tremendous amount of effort understanding the history, how Max Weber influenced things. It's, for example, political science is a great example, right? And yet in criminology, we really don't offer that. In a sense, the evolution of ideas and how those ideas are based on certain facts that we view them, historical facts, historical situations. But yet I find time and time again, many of those cases have never been subjected to any form of really stringent historical scrutiny. And in doing so, we find that oftentimes that those answers are very different. So the first chapter goes into the genesis of this mythology, the genesis of the thought, from the concept of the notion of what does mafia mean and how does it, you know, how is this term arrived, you know? So we look at the linguistics and we look at other things and we, you know, where did it come from? What's the record of it? What's the longest time in the past that we can find it being used and in what context? And then we start to look at the social construction of the term and its development over time, how it came to mean many different things at many different times, and how eventually with the major commission hearings in the United States, the McClellan Committee and the Kefauver Committee hearing, on top of a couple of other events, that this really started to take a life of its own. And that life was interesting because as it was being broadcast as a mythology in the form of books and eventually films like The Godfather and other things, the actual documents in the committee hearings actually had a completely different conclusion, a completely different perspective on this. So as a result of that, there was a major disconnect. And if I'm a theorist and I'm looking at crime and I want to understand this, if I find out that one of my assumptions going into that social scientific research and social scientific theory is historically invalid, I would want to fix that and see what the implications are for the theory development or the policy development that comes from the theory. So that's what we do. We tell the story of that, in a sense, the historiography of the concept. And we rely heavily on the fact that there's some wonderful scholars out there who've done some good work on this. And we, you know, obviously borrow heavily from them. And we also try to bring it together in a coherent way that lets people understand that a lot of the things that we see when we're sitting in a hotel room in, you know, in Mumbai or something on the A&E channel or Discovery Channel, that a lot of that oftentimes is a community of legends with half facts and partial facts and maybe true facts, but from a historical standpoint may not be valid. And so we need to have some skepticism and we need to look at this in a way, I think, that methodologically many criminologists haven't been trained to do, in the United States at least. And I think everybody benefits as a result.
Well, honestly, I've had this idea for a year. I'd love to have a journal of history of organized crime for that reason, ever since I read some of the books you've been referring to, because we found the same thing looking at outlaw motorcycle gangs, where the accepted history has absolutely no basis in fact, but policies are developed based on these histories.
So it's actually very important. Yeah, there's an interesting thing. When I was a grad student at Penn State, there was some research being presented to the faculty and other graduate students, and it was dealing with the riots in a particular U.S. city, and somebody gave this incredible like analysis with all the statistics of the arrests and the locations and all these other things and wonderful things, and then I kept looking at Alan Block at the time. We were in this together, and we just kept looking at each other and looking at each other, and we're like, because we were both thinking the same thing. And then he's this great voice. He sounds, you know, he's from Brooklyn, and he's like, hey kid, you gonna ask or am I gonna ask? And I'm like, I said, hey, you go ahead and ask. You know, you're the boss. Like, you can do it. You know, he's like, so we had this great little way of talking to each other. So when my grandpa's genes obviously are in the in my blood, but he basically asked the question. He says, did you ever talk to anybody that was involved with these riots? Did you ever go and look at archival research on this riots, like in the memos and the, you know, all the different things? Did you go to the African American History Museum in your own city? Did you go and look at these things and collect information that could shed light on those statistics to show whether or not that was an accurate sample, whether or not there was other sides to the story? And, well, no, why would I do that? Was the response. And to me, that's devastating from a research standpoint. And I saw this even when the Chinese organized crime grant that I put together for a major grant agency at the time of my dissertation research. It was funny. You get these peer reviews and there's four of them. Three of them were like, five, this is great. It needs to be done. It was wonderful. Nobody's ever done this before. Then the fourth one gives it like a zero, like a zero, but like a one or something, or two, and says, where's the longitudinal analysis? It's like I'm questioning the assumption that goes into the analysis. Yeah. But this just reflects, I mean, my thing is that these methodologies are not mutually exclusive from each other. Great scholarship comes from when you blend these different disciplines and bring these different methodological approaches together. I mean, in my own research that I've done on a variety of things, I mean, I delve heavily into anthropology. I got heavily into, you know, all these different fields and the social networking theory before it was, you know, big. It was back in the, you know, 90s. And I wrote an article on that back in the 90s and saying that we need to be using this as a methodology. I learned so much from that. And even right now, I'm looking at stuff, for example, history on the 30 Years' War, the 100 Years' War, as ways of understanding the role of organized crime groups, essentially, as they worked as power brokers and as they worked for the emerging nation states in Europe at that time, and how they brought, you know, there's so many different fields we can look in, rich, rich fields that might not have organized crime attached to it, but they're talking about what it is that we do as scholars. And to me, that's phenomenal, because how does this relate to a practitioner? This relates to a practitioner because of the fact that the laws and the policies that are constructed are oftentimes created by this mythology. And I can tell you time and time and time again, working with federal law enforcement, intelligence folks or military folks that really do tip of the lance work on this stuff, you know, that it's like, yeah, this research is irrelevant to us. It's not really helping me. You know what I mean? There needs to be something more sound here. And you know, later on, I might be able to talk about it, but that's where my work's branching out now, which is trying to create this language and this that reflects the utility of what really is happening versus how we as academics have constructed it so far. And so the first step in doing this, deal with the history, look at the legend, identify the legends, illustrate that there's more complex stories there, that some of the legend's true, some of it's false, some of it's somewhere in between, and kind of allow that as a foundation for analyzing organized crime in different ways.
Yeah. Well, I think that's absolutely important. I agree with everything you're saying there. But as you say, there's a lot of career paths that get caught up in the minutia, especially in the methodologies too. So people are so caught up in how they're going to look at something, they no longer question the basis on which they're going to do it. And that's true. Anytime you go to a conference, you can see that
happening
around you. Yeah.
Well, it's really funny. As an observation, organized crime dominates. Travis, as you well know, organized crime just dominates so much coverage in our media in terms of policy. There's a whole moral panic right now with sex trafficking. And there's all, before that, it's drug trafficking. And then it's this, then a weapons trafficking scandal with like Victor Boot, for example, and out of Thailand and, you know, and his arrest there. All these different things create these kind of little moral panics. But not only that, they're very substantive because they influence things like, you know, fundraising for major terrorist organizations or how, you know, nation states are using organized crime as a way of keeping themselves in power and, you know, state actors basically working as organized criminals. These are very pressing issues where literally lives are at stake and harms are being done. And in some cases, even organized crime might be actually benefiting communities and doing certain things because of the, you know, power structures that exist in a certain area. But the thing is, this is a very big deal. But yet when you go to the conferences, I mean, as you well know, you're American Society of Criminology. How many of us were in the room for organized crime for the meeting?
20.
There's about 20 of us.
Yeah.
And there's hundreds and hundreds. And there's all these fresh, minted PhDs. Yeah. And everybody running around. And they're all doing the same thing. Social control theory or, you know, this and that. The strain theory and this and that. And that there's anything wrong with that. I think it's not like George Costanza and Seinfeld. But not that there's anything wrong with that. But the thing is that it strikes me as fundamentally irresponsible as a discipline to leave such an important policy-related issue that's just ripe for research Yep. There's so many different places we can go that haven't been gone yet. And to be able to tackle that in some interesting ways. I'd love to have folks with those skill sets. I mean, I'm not a numbers guy. I mean, I've never met a number I liked except for the ones in my wallet. But it's like the thing is that I could benefit from having people who can do that and work with me and work these things out. And that's good research. That's strong. To me, that's substantive research. But like you identified earlier, the way academia is going is to get further and further into stovepipes. Where I really think we need to be doing is basically decentralizing, like organized crime, as I view it, is going on globally. So
yeah, well, as I say to all my new students, study organized crime because anything you do will be original. There's so few mm-hmm. people working on it. It's actually harder to copy someone else than it is to do something that's fresh.
Yeah, yeah. The analogy I give is if you're a paleontologist and you're looking for species of the new Brontosaurus or something, the Velociraptor, why are you going to go to the same place everybody else is digging? You want to go to the place that nobody else went. And this advice was given to me when I was starting out in my career. I think it was Alan that told me this. He says, Jeff, you can sit and do everything else like a blackbird's on a wire. If a hunter sees those and he takes a shot at them, all those birds are flying off in one direction to escape. But where's the hunter aiming? They're all aiming in that same flock. You want to be the one going the opposite direction. That's evolutionary survival. And I think that, if you look at organized crime research, it's like being that one blackbird. You can do so many interesting things because there's so many places that have yet to be explored. I mean, the history of organized crime in Australia or Cambodia or this place, and there's volumes to be written on. There's careers can be made, and society as a whole would be enriched by this because these are very relevant to the problem sets that societies face today. For example, hazardous waste disposal and the history of that, and all these different things that are out there. So if you're an environmentalist, understand the history of the role of organized crime and dumping toxic stuff in people's neighborhoods and the water supplies. If you want to understand why conflicts are breaking out, consider the Iraq War. You have a sanctions regime meant to, in a sense, to prevent a war from occurring, but that was the absolute most ridiculous thing in the world in terms of the corruption and the vast amount of blatant violations. To this day, I've found nobody else that's read the Dulfa report, the Iraqi Survey Group report, that found that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, he said that, but at the same point, the Iraqi Survey Group said a lot of other things and said, it's still, there's this major issue here that's just as strategically significant. And what he was saying and what he concluded was that, members of the permanent members of the UN Security Council were violating the sanctions to a degree that basically let Iraq get anything they wanted unimpeded. That's me paraphrasing the quote. That's essentially what's going on. So if you're interested in ideas of, no blood for oil, or you want, peace at any cost, it's imperative to understand organized crime and how this works, because it has a direct impact on the massive events that influences so many lives around the globe.
Yeah. Well, as someone else who did read that report, it was one of the areas I started studying when I came to academia, and I had to concentrate back on organized crime.
Welcome to the club. There's two of us now.
yes. Well, interestingly, I was also one of the first people, the first person in my family to go to university, and my family are all bookies. So not
great
quite
minds. I'm telling you.
Yeah, it drives you in a particular direction.
I think, I know, you must be Scott as well, because
I got half Scottish too, don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. So we got it.
Yeah. Okay, so having said all the things we've been saying, what actually is organized crime? Because it's a word or a term that's thrown around, and I don't think you'd find two random people who'd have the same definition of it.
No, absolutely not. And Joe and I actually recognize that in the book, saying that nobody's ever going to get a concrete definition of organized crime. I mean, we can't, especially on the policy level. I mean, the UN can't do it. The United States doesn't have an official, definition of organized crime. And in many ways, it's like an article I published in the mid-1990s in Justice Quarterly. I said, trying to get a definition of organized crime is like akin to nailing Jell-O to a wall. It's just very, very nebulous, which is why, in many ways, what we advocate is that don't look at it as a noun. Don't look at it as organized crime a noun. Once you do that, you're setting limitations to the subject that you're going to be looking towards. You basically, now you have a sense of, okay, here's an organized crime family, or here's a group, or here's a network. But once you do that, you're limiting yourself to really the social embeddedness, the economic embeddedness, the political embeddedness, the other things that go along with it. I prefer, and Joe prefers, we like to look at it as a verb. as a process. And as a matter of fact, in the book that basically the first title I wanted to do was called Organizing Crime, Verb. And basically it was being nixed because, well, it wouldn't show up in the search engines. And if we'd had it that way, if people type it in, it's not going to show up. So what you saw was editorial content subverting, in a sense, the fact that if you type in some keywords into Google or something else, the book might not come up because it's using ing instead of ed. And what we were saying is that what we're really talking about is organizing crime as a process. And as a process, there are specific steps from the very beginning to the very end that if we look at this, think of it in these terms. If you're a Bolivian farmer and you're putting a seed in the ground, from the moment where did you get the seed? Where did you get everything that goes along with that, the fertilizers, and then of course the harvesting, the equipment, whose land are you using, and how'd you get to use that land? Then of course it goes through the logistics to the warehousing and to the processing, and then from there it goes to the teamsters that take it into the whatever the port of export is, and then from there, if you go all the way to the point where somebody actually takes that and snorts it or smokes it, how many, literally thousands of people can be touched by that one particular seed, right? Mm. Now, politically, that's a problem. Politically, because if we look at organized crime in this regard and say, okay, well, I'm going to identify the drug traffickers, right? What we're essentially doing is recognizing that if we go after that drug trafficking, what we're inherently doing is going after its embeddedness in the larger global body politic. And what we have here, in a sense, is this notion, this persistent notion that organized crime is a virus, that it enters the body and it takes it over, and the body would otherwise be whole if not but for this virus. But the reality is the virus is actually part the body itself, part of the body, a very vital, important to the part to the body. It is something that no matter where you go in time and space, and this goes to my current research, which is on the global history of organized crime. I'm surveying literally just hundreds and hundreds of articles and books from, ancient Mayan civilizations to, Han Dynasty China to, Central Asia and the Silk Routes. And what I'm seeing are the same behaviors time and time again. They might be called something different, but it's the same thing. People have turned to this as a way of what the great French social historian Fernand Braudel calls for climbing out of hell. That in many parts of the world, you have to create what he calls a counter society from scratch to have any sense of social mobility whatsoever. And that's just a given throughout human history. And so organizing crime, in a sense, to me, is not necessarily an inherently good or bad thing. Okay, what it is it's just a way human beings have dealt with situations that they have found that have been based upon the constructions of whatever government they have, religion they have, etc. And this is a fascinating thing. Consider this example. If I have a grad student right now, we're working on this, and we'll hope to turn this into an article pretty soon. But the idea of the Underground Railroad during the American Civil War, the Underground Railroad took people who were trying to escape the barbarity of slavery. One of the worst things that you can imagine is losing one's liberty and being forced to be viewed as property, being torn asunder from your family and everything else. Then good people, well-intended people, go out to take individuals, to take them from slavery and out of bondage, and get them to the freedom of Canada up to the north. What are they essentially doing? Strip away all of that, it's human trafficking.
Yep.
Taking people from one place, it's also taking stolen property. Because remember, at this time, slaves were viewed as property, not as necessarily human beings. So what you're talking about here is, in a sense, good people, well-meaning people, pastors and priests and, the town matrons and everything else, having this massive network to move people. I would argue that that's a good thing. That organized crime, in a sense, has a good thing. A companion to this, think about the Holocaust and surviving the Holocaust. Rubenstein's book on the cunning of history talks about the notion of what happens when you're completely have citizenship taken away from you. You're a stateless person. You are completely at the whim of that law. You have no legal protections. You can't get open bank accounts. You can't transfer property. You can't do anything. And yet people have to survive. So one of the things I have another grad student looking at as part of another article I'm working on is looking at the Holocaust and using that. And for example, consider Schindler's List as a gangster film, right? What did Oscar Schindler do? He, paid off the upper world folks who were corrupt. There were black markets involved. There were false documents. There were all these different things that come with any sort of criminal enterprise. So the organizing of the crime as it was said in Schindler's List, is an absolute good, right?
Yep.
But the process remains the same. And if we can go back and look at this as a process and understand the component parts of that process that are consistent across time and space, we're well on our way to developing a macro theory of organized crime that can be subjected to all the different, you know, testing with a very strong basis for empirical, you know, for empirical research.
Yeah. Well, one of the things on my list that's been there for far too long is very similar. It's the underground economy that was working in the Japanese prison camp in Changi in Singapore amongst the Australian and British. And the beautiful thing is, it's one of the very few illicit economies that we know all about because the participants have all moved from there and talked about it. Mm-hmm. And there's not many illicit economies where you can actually discover what actually happened inside from all the players.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one of the things we're looking at are, for example, like Holocaust survivor narratives, and the Shoah Foundation and others provide this. But these are just examples of many other processes. In other places, for example, you can just see it as you travel the world and you're in a place like Chennai in India, you know, and I want to get a cricket jersey for my kid. I can go to the mall and spend $90 just like I would here in the States for that. For a cricket jersey for my son, or I can go across the street to the market and I can get it for $5,
yep.
Right? And the reality is that there's people that $90 is in many cases more than a month's salary. These are phantom losses. I talk about this in an article on film piracy. These losses don't really exist in the real world because nobody was going to spend that much money to go to that theater in Chennai to watch the latest, you know, Katherine Heigl love pick or something. It just wasn't going to happen. So my wife might, but but the thing is that when you look at these sort of things, we have to recognize that the way you climb out of hell is to organize, and the interest of those, and mind you, the furthest thing you would talk about from being a Marxist or anything else, this is just pure economic reality. But when you look at the way the laws are constructed, they protect the existing businesses for reasons, for legitimate reasons. But that doesn't benefit other people. And those individuals, in a sense, are going to do what it takes to move forward. Some will do it on legitimate pathways or illegitimate pathways, and with all the attendant risks that come along with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things you do in the book is you run through different areas where organized crime takes place and explain pretty much what you've just been talking about, how the organization of this criminal activity advantages the participants. So do you want to run through one of them, say, like the numbers game or something like that, and explain that process?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we do, and this is where Joe's lifetime of research comes into play. And, you know, he's, as any scholar, you probably have about, you know, 20 articles on your, you know, in various stages of completion on your computer, you know, and Joe had that. And he wanted to kind of go through some of the things because Joe was a keen observer of people. He had a very strong background in psychology. He understood, he was a very, very, very astute observer. And he was in Michigan, in Detroit for a while, and then he went to UNLV and University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And he's a person that I used to joke. He's like, yeah, basically I'm hanging out with the gamblers and in Vegas and the dealers, and then I'm going to the strip clubs, understand the prostitution stuff, and I'm doing. I said, okay, you're just hanging out in strip clubs. He's like, no, it's about this. I'd give him a hard time about it. So when everybody can do that research, right? It would all get funded. But he would go around the world to London and Russia and other places, and he would observe and he would talk, and he was so nice and so sweet. People talked to him and they opened up. And as a result of that, he was able to put together some fascinating studies. And the gambling one here begins with the fact that he grew up in Western Pennsylvania, in an area where there was a lot of, you know, what we would call traditional organized crime, but largely Italian-American criminal networks in various places. Never that he knew, and nobody that he knew that he grew up that were in this, whoever felt it was part of a national conspiracy or international conspiracy, it was just the local guys, you know, networking with each other from town to town. But he started seeing this and he started paying attention to, okay, how does this work? What does it take to run a hidden gambling game? Nowadays, the internet and all, you know, casinos everywhere, it's easy to do. When you think about trying to find a place if you wanted to gamble, what it would take in terms of security, confidence, in terms of the dealers and their, you know, all the different things that can go on with that. So what we do in the book is we start just going, how is the crime organized? What is the process? And by just looking at how the process works, and this mirrors, by the way, Peter Reuter's great work, you know, in Disorganized Crime, where he looks at loan sharking and other things, and you realize that just the way it's organized, you can't create a monopoly over the stuff. You can't do it. I tell my students all the time, like, I hear the, you know, like Super Bowl bettings, you know, they want to bet on the Super Bowl or they want to bet on the NCAA men's basketball tournament. And I said, you know, that's a felony in the state of California to do that. You can't go to any dormitory here at the university without office, basically office pool betting going on. Now, the mob's not going to ever be any way, shape, or form being able to monopolize that. It's just impossible. So you just look at the, some of the common sense nature of this. That doesn't mean that organized crime can't get involved with things like it did in Vegas and some other things. But what it shows you is that there's this inherent decentralization that occurs, that if you follow the process, you recognize that very few enterprises are subject to monopoly. It's a very difficult thing to achieve, and it's a very difficult thing to hold on to, because there's always changes in the marketplace. There's always changes moving forward, and things begin to move forward, like I said, as a film. And so what we try to do is, by illustrate, looking at gambling, for example, is showing how that process has evolved all the way to the point now of internet gaming, which I always thought was really hysterical, because I'm gonna put money on online, and I'm gonna say, okay, I'm gonna put $1,000 in an account, then I'm gonna go on a computer and hit a button with a slot machine. And tell me how that can't be just, you know. I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm a little too tight with my money, and not, you know, but you know, right now, my brother-in-law likes to play online poker, and he does it all the time. And apparently, there's other people he's playing against, but I don't know if that's true or not. But the point is, it's ripe for scams. And
there's another side to it too. I mean, in Australia, they got rid of bookies by the government taking it over and actually running their own bookie shops. What was different about it? Nothing really. It's just the government took the cut instead of the bookmakers taking the cut.
Oh, and that's true. But this once again goes to my point. There's these base needs. There's these base, you know, societal demands for different illicit goods and services, or not just illicit, but overly regulated. For example, hazardous waste disposal, or, you know, there's a really high import or tariff on an imported good, like for cigarettes. It's cigarette and oil smuggling, obviously. So if there's that demand, people are going to meet it. In some cases, the state might decide they're going to be the one to do it, you know? And that takes away, but it doesn't change the fundamental need, and it doesn't take away the fact that government now has what Charles Reich, the famous Yale legal scholar, coined as the new property. The idea being that property is just not land or a car or something else. Property is also that piece of paper that a building inspector has that can shut down Trump Tower being built in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And that discretion that civil servant has can cost millions of dollars if he shuts down that work site. So if that person or his bosses, say the political machine, says, give us $100,000 or $1 million to make sure your site doesn't get done, all of a sudden you see how government is inherently an entrepreneurial profession. That's been the norm historically. What we're dealing with in like liberal Western democracies now is this anachronism, yet it still goes on. It's still rampant. So what you see now, not having studied this directly, but I would wager to bet, is that if you were to look at organized crime, the gambling issues regarding the state, there are people that will be in these civil servant positions or political appointees who are being given taking money and doing certain things to give certain people the contracts, or making sure certain technologies are being used, or making sure, you know, all that different stuff, that it doesn't, it just changes the face of the problem. The crime gets organized differently, you know, as the verb, but the same basic roles and functions are going to be carried out. It's just different actors.
Yeah, no, well, that's absolutely true. We've been going for quite a while now, so we might move on to the normal final question, which is, what are you working on now? Now, you've touched on that quite a bit, but do you want to expand any more upon the other book that you're writing?
Yeah, well, right now, it could be one book, it could end up being two. Basically, I've been working on that global history of organized crime, the way of trying to look at this activity across time and space. And it is absolutely phenomenal what can be found. For example, you can go to homilies by like the Bishop of Alexandria in the 3rd century, you know, where they're talking about usury. And you're reading about usury, we're talking about his loan sharking, right? You're talking about any sensitivism's going on. And you're seeing the impact of that and the harms and how it's structured the way it is. And you can go to, you know, 15th century coastal China, and you can have government inspectors. It's great. they go in there and they're saying, you know what, we came here to look at this piracy and the smuggling going on, but there's no way we can deal with this. You know, there's too many families, too many clans. We shut one down. I mean, I have a letter I reprinted from a couple of Chinese smugglers, one in the book that we're discussing here. It was two Chinese smugglers, and one of them was in San Francisco and one was in Hong Kong. And one of them says, you know what? I have the ability to pay off this customs guy. If you can get that over there in Hong Kong, we can get a monopoly on the whole trade. And his uncle, you know, uncle, using the term uncle parentheses, says, no. You have schemes, others have schemes. Don't get fixated on control. Recognize that there's enough for everybody, that we have our people, they have their people. We're going to get this done. But when you see that wording, it's the same as inspectors now and the old silk routes that they have going through the deserts in China. They're uncovering these big cities where all the documents are preserved. And in these documents, they find, basically, you think of the customs guy, right? And he's writing the same stuff. And you go back to the ancient Rome, it's the same thing. The game continues. It remains the same, no matter where you are in time and space. And so the book will be dealing with that. But one of the subsets of this comes from my other job, basically, which is working for the War College for U.S. Special Operations Command, U.S. SOCOM. And in that capacity, I'm responsible for teaching the curriculum related to organized crime and war fighting and intelligence and other areas along those lines. And one of the things I'm very interested in the role and function of organized crime and warfare. Phil Williams has done some wonderful work on this and some others. But essentially, I want to look at the history of this. And so I've been collecting the information on that. Whether that will be folded into the one, I don't know.
Right.
But I will at least be getting a report out. There's a scholarly journal that comes out in the military community that I'll probably be putting that out in, not in the criminological realm. But basically, looking at this from the standpoint of how is organized criminality a fungible asset, and how it can be used in terms of the state using it or adversaries and state and non-state actors using it. And that goes to this larger issue. And when you look at the notion of this, what Alan Block called the serious crime community, there are those that service this around the globe. That you see their names in the BCCI scandal and savings and loans, you know, the real estate crisis. Their names are always in the index, yet nothing ever happens. Why is that? Because they're working for the state here, they're working for the bad guys here, they're working for this intelligence agency here, they're working for that military group over here, this terrorist group over there. So if they ever are in trouble, they trade secrets, they trade information, they broker that information as a way of providing impunity from the law, impunity, which goes to reinforce the large point I made earlier. This is timeless. This is the body. You know, if we're focusing on these viruses that we want to eradicate, it's just not going to happen. You would need those structures to eradicate the virus.
Yeah.
At the same point, the United States prosecuted Victor Boot for all his massive logistics empire that he had for, you know, providing weapons all around the world, among other things, drugs, everything else. Our military also contracted with him, and allied militaries, coalition partners in Afghanistan, to bring that material. Why? He had the airplanes that can get into these horrible landing strips in the middle of nowhere. He had this great fleet of former Soviet airplanes that he can roll out. Oh, yeah, by the way, can you use AKs too? You know, it's like, you know, so there's a utility to this. And so you have this interesting thing where the right hand and left hand are oftentimes at contrary purposes. I always feel sorry for the DEA agents who actually got this guy arrested in Thailand, because he probably got a lot of people upset in their own government by doing this. And the thing is, the reality is we see that all the time on the local level. I live in San Diego, where the drug issue is a huge one. There's protected people. There's people that we make rope. You know, we have relationships with one cartel because it's giving intel on another cartel. We have relationships with one warlord because that warlord is working, you know, their enemy is our enemy, you know, and we make these judgments. This goes to this notion of the social construction of crime we talk about in this. The state has the power to make these problems appear or go away at a whim, usually for political reasons. And as a result of that, you can sit and say, you know, today's freedom fighter, tomorrow's terrorist, that cliche. But you get today organized crime criminal, tomorrow's, you know, pure patriot. The Anbar Awakening is a perfect example of this. You had a variety of tribes that historically, I was advising folks over in Iraq at the time on this very issue, was that if you start shutting down the smuggling pipelines that the Bedouins were bringing in material from Syria, these are pipelines that have been going on for just centuries. And what that does is it goes to the local sheikhs and others who are the important people that make a lot of money off of this stuff. And all if you're going to start breaking down that economic cash flow, all of a sudden you're going to see a backlash. This and not only that, you're going to see them turn to kidnapping. as a way of making money, because kidnapping will always occur when there's a vacuum in terms of the normal criminal enterprise. We saw it in Mexico, we see it all over the world. And what did we see? All these kidnappings occur where people were selling the hostages to the highest bidder, be they the Brits, the U.S., or Al-Qaeda. You know, this is who they were doing
That's right.
And then you see the awakening. And what was the awakening? You had Al-Qaeda come in these places, these foreign fighters, and they come in as a friend, you know, we're going to do this. And then what they do is say, oh, by the way, oh, yeah, we're going to take over this operation. You need to start paying protection to us. You know, we'll call it a zakat, but you're paying the protection over to us now. And by the way, our people are going to go to work. And then you add to that, you're going to marry your daughter to us, and you're going to do this. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the tribes realize, oh, wait a second, the devil we thought we were fighting is actually not bad at all compared to the devil that we have in our midst. And in literally, all the research coming out of the Anbar Awakening illustrates this very clearly. You saw the same thing in Mosul. You saw the same thing in other places throughout Iraq and other areas. One of the biggest things, I look forward to the revisionist history in Iraq. It's so much different than the narrative that we currently have. When you look at outside actors coming in, you look at the drug trafficking, you look at what Iran was involved with. I mean, it ties in all these different factors that and Phil Williams has gone a long way. He has an unpublished manuscript on this you can look up online. That basically is a book size. He did it for National Defense University, and it was a book size report that really illustrates the interconnectivity of organized criminal behavior with tribal constructs and also the various religious factions that existed, and how those were leveraged as part of the larger power struggles that were occurring in Iraq, and how outside actors are doing the same thing, just like we see in Mexico right now.
Oh, yeah.
Where you have other nation states picking cartels, picking drug networks, what are essentially warlords to bank on in case they get power in that region, so they can bring their intel people in, they can provide the market for their weapons, they can bring their insurgents or the terrorists through their particular tunnels. All that's going down right now.
Well, look, thank you very much for the interview as well. We've been talking to Jeff McElwain about deconstructing organized crime. Thank you again, Jeff.
No, thank you so much.